Blog Talk Radio.
Mama.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. Once again, we have a great episode. I'm glad that you all are able to tune in, whether it may be live or on archive. We have a fabulous guest today, an unbelievable guest. You know, he's working his way onto the show as a correspondent, and we're happy to have him bequeath his knowledge, his expertise, his insight. And the information that he consistently compiles on not just a weekly, but a daily basis. And that is none other than Abiyomi Ezekwe, who will be joining us in a few minutes from Detroit, Michigan, to give us some insight and perspectives on a range of things. And I say he's worked his way in, I say that facetiously. He's a comrade of mine, and I've just been a fan of his website and his work for a long time. He's the chief editor for Pan-African Newswire, and you can reach that by going to www.panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com, and he updates it pretty much sometimes hourly with information throughout not just Africa, not just throughout the African diaspora, but throughout the world, and a range of things that are related to geopolitics, that are related to domestic issues within the artificial borders that we call the United States of America, but also through the Caribbean, you know, everywhere. He's a tremendous, tremendous asset to those seeking to combat, you know, the corporate media slant, you know, often narrowly shaped and focused slant, you know. So he's definitely going to be appreciated once again on the show. And so he'll be joining us in a few moments. You know, welcome. You know, this 20th day of December 2009, as we approach the beginning of the new calendar. You know, if you follow the so-called Roman calendar. So, it is, you know, as I said, so-called. I say that facetiously as well. But it's once again, like I said, a pleasure to have you with us today. If you want to call in at any point during the interview with Abiomi Ezekwe, please do so. The call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. Once the interview starts, you guys have an opportunity to call in and with questions, comments, and if you just simply even want to just engage yourself with the dialogue. So without further ado, I want to start with a couple of headlines, and when we come back, probably maybe either from this headline, this news bit that we get from Black and Indian Report, or the next one, we'll be joined by Brother Abiomi Ezekwe. And, you know, as usual, as I always say, we will hit the ground running. We'll get into a myriad of things related to a ton of issues, a lot going on in the news, a lot to discuss, a lot of things to be put into its proper prospect. And hopefully when you guys get this information, you know, you will, you know, do the same and spread the information far and wide into your community, into your networks, because that's, like I said, that's one of the tools that we have to use to combat this this premeditated dumbing down that we see going on by the mainstream corporate media, as well as mainstream outlets such as mainstream vessels such as public education, colleges, and so forth. That, you know, they are as complicit as well. You step into most classes on college campuses, you know, you see the same kind of narrowly shaped propaganda going on. And so, you know, we got to combat that by using the means that we have, and that's each other, and to spread this information as a tool to mobilize, organize, to galvanize. And so we're going to have this brief news bit from Black Agenda Report. And when we're joined meet once again on the other side of this report, we'll be met with Abiomi Ezekwe, and we'll get into a range of things. So buckle yourself in and stay tuned in. Thank you once again for joining us.
There is no greater testimony to the vast amount of ground Black America has lost over the past three decades than the Congressional Black Caucus's recent press conference on the need for jobs and elementary fairness in the current economic crisis. Caucus Chairperson Barbara Lee began with a brief outline of the long-standing and in some cases worsening economic disparities that afflict African Americans, facts that are well known to the White House and congressional leadership to whom the caucus's appeal was directed. The Black lawmakers found it necessary to point out that they are morally obligated to address these systemic inequalities, obligations that President Obama has categorically rejected on numerous occasions, invoking the rich man's slogan, A rising tide lifts all boats. A generation ago, such reactionary nonsense would have been met with wholesale denunciation in black political circles. But as we begin the second decade of the 21st century, a black Democrat in the White House can get away with speaking like Ronald Reagan, while black members of Congress are compelled to present moral justification for seeking redress of economic injustices. 40 years ago, a Republican president, Richard Nixon, would have felt quite comfortable agreeing with the black caucus's concerns about economic fairness. Yet today, the nation's first black president bristles at every suggestion that gross racial inequalities call for executive and legislative action. So great is the weight of decades of right-wing assaults on the very idea of economic parity among the races, black congresspeople feel the need to repeatedly emphasize that they are not proposing racial formulas for job creation, but programs based on need, on the principle that those who have been harmed the most should be targeted for greater assistance. "We're not talking about race," said Chairperson Barbara Lee. "We're talking about the hardest hit." And in fact, the United States Congress has never funded a program to create black jobs, but rather they have created jobs in urban America and jobs for residents of areas with high levels of poverty. President Obama treats every appeal for attention to black unemployment as if it is an unreasonable or even illegal demand. To be blunt, he sounds just like those professional white racists that make their livings claiming blacks seek new and special privileges, when nothing could be further from the truth. The Black Caucus proposes to bring back jobs programs from the 70s. Detroit's Carolyn Kirkpatrick would like to see the rebirth of the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, CETA. And Representative John Conyers would reinvigorate the Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment Act, which has been on the books, unfunded, for over 30 years. No one is talking about reinventing the wheel in jobs creation. For two generations, during every election cycle, blacks have demanded a Marshall Plan to combat unemployment in the cities, where it just so happens that most black people live. Every election cycle, that is, until the last one, when black politicians made no demands whatsoever on candidate Barack Obama. Black America is now paying the cost of giving Obama a free pass. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So as promised, we'll probably get into some of the intersectionalities that connect to that story that we just heard on from our brother Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report. But as promised, like I said, we have Brother Abiyomi Ezekwe, editor and founder of Pan-African Newswire. And once again, that website is www.panafricannews.blogspot.com. And we'll give you that website again before we leave the air this afternoon. But Brother Abiyomi Ezekwe is with us right now, and brother, if you could, to those new listeners that are tuning in right now, or maybe tuning in when the show is archived, could you introduce yourself and kind of talk about, what your work represents with Pan African Newswire and all the other great work that you do, and then once you're done with that, make a smooth transition into some of the news that is kind of preeminent right now in the U.S. and I guess globally, but it happened, it happened in Detroit on Christmas Day, and that's the news of the Nigerian brother who was at the center of this story, who was the suspect or allegedly, had a device strapped to his undergarment and was allegedly caught trying to blow up a Delta/Northwest airliner from Amsterdam.
Well, good afternoon, and I just wanted to mention that the Pan-African Newswire is international daily Pan-African news source. It was formed in 1998. We're going to be commemorating our 12th anniversary next month. It's an international electronic press service that's designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. As I mentioned before, it was formed in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, magazines, journals, and websites throughout the world. And hopefully we will be able to continue in the next decade to research, to write, and to disseminate this information throughout both the city of Detroit as well as the international community. So it's an honor to be here once again participating in this great radio program.
Thank you. Thank you. And you're definitely more than appreciated. You enhance our show immensely. The particulars of this story have yet to surface, and they're just, you know, and I know you, I saw a piece that you posted, numerous pieces that you posted on your website recently regarding this incident that happened on Christmas Day in Detroit. But for me, it seems like there's certain things that are missing. Something just doesn't seem to mesh. And I don't know about the particulars, but what is your take on this incident, and what insight have you garnered from your research around this most recent incident at the airport in Detroit, Michigan?
Well, it's quite interesting that this happened on Christmas Day, that it has now taken over the entire news reporting that's being disseminated domestically and internationally. On December 25th, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who is 23 years old and is a Nigerian national, was arrested on Delta Airline flight coming from Amsterdam to Detroit. They said that he was attempting to ignite an incendiary device that would have caused serious damage to the plane and its passengers. They're saying that this is an attempted terrorist attack against the United States and its citizens. They're also saying that he may have had some affiliation with Al-Qaeda. There was a news report that was just released earlier today saying that the Al-Qaeda organization based in Yemen had claimed responsibility in this attempted attack. We have not been able to determine the veracity and authenticity of this announcement. Also, the president just did a brief press conference from his vacation in Hawaii, talking about how he's going to initiate a review of Homeland Security procedures governing the Transportation and Security Administration, the TSA, which actually runs airports across the United States. So it's still a developing story, but we do know that this is definitely going to be utilized to enhance internal security within the United States, not only in regard to airline transportation, but also other aspects of homeland security in the United States. We also know that there are many things that are going on both domestically and internationally that this incident will inevitably have an impact upon. For example, the current situation now in Yemen, the United States has been spending a considerable amount of time in Yemen. Just 3-4 days ago, there was a major attack against a group of people who the U.S. intelligence services claim were members and supporters of Al-Qaeda. Dozens of them were killed. They're claiming that the actual operations were carried out by elements within the Yemeni government. But the U.S. is admitting and has admitted through an Associated Press report that was issued that this thing, in fact, was supported and even coordinated by the United States. I just want to quote briefly from an Associated Press report that was issued on December 25th. It says that, quote, Yemen's military hit suspected the Al-Qaeda hideouts for the second time in a week, killing at least 30 militants in a remote area of the country, a fragmented, unstable nation the U.S. fears could turn into an Afghanistan-like refuge for the terrorist network. The report continues by saying that the strikes on Thursday, which was December 24th, which were carried out with U.S. and Saudi intelligence help, I think that's a key point in this dispatch, hit a gathering of top leaders and other targets in a remote mountain valley, officials said. The newly aggressive Yemeni campaign against al-Qaeda is being boosted by a dose of American aid, a reflection of Washington's concerns about al-Qaeda's presence in a highly strategic location on the border with oil-rich ally Saudi Arabia. This same Associated Press article goes on to point out that, quote, the Pentagon recently confirmed it has poured nearly $70 million U.S. dollars in military aid into Yemen this year only, compared with none in 2008. The U.S. military has boosted its counterterrorism training for Yemeni forces and is providing more intelligence, according to U.S. officials and analysts. The result appears to be a sharp escalation in Yemen's campaign against al-Qaeda, which previously amounted to scattered raids against militants mixed with tolerance of some fighters who made vague promises they would avoid terrorist activities, unquote. Therefore, it's quite obvious that Yemen is a major target of U.S. military and intelligence activities. And corporate media reports continue to emphasize what it calls the unstable character of Yemen, and it's labeling the country as a, quote, failed state, unquote, as it did with Afghanistan during the invasion of 2001. So in regard to Yemen, we have seen and we can expect to see more U.S. military involvement in that particular country, which is very strategically located around the Red Sea, close to the Gulf of Aden, where we already have dozens upon dozens of warships, flotillas of these warships from the United States, from Britain, from France, from other countries around the world that are supposedly engaging in an anti-piracy campaign right off the Horn of Africa. Also, these ships are also stepping up their patrols in the Indian Ocean as well. Now, Yemen is located on the Arabian Peninsula right next to Saudi Arabia, which is a key U.S. ally. So, of course, we can see clearly this is going to have a tremendous impact on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East as well as the Horn of Africa. Now, in terms of Nigeria, where Farouk Abdul Mutlaib is from, there's been a lot of developments in Nigeria over the last several months that has drawn the attention of U.S. Foreign policy analysts as well as the Obama administration. Nigeria has been the scene of unrest in the north several months ago, where the Nigerian military and the police killed several hundred people in a crackdown against an Islamic group that calls itself the Boko Haram, where the leader of this group was killed by the police in Nigeria in the north extrajudiciously. Was done on Nigerian television. There's also been a flare-up in fighting in the Niger Delta region, where most of the oil is produced in this West African state. And what's key in relationship to this is the fact that the major oil companies in Nigeria that have dominated the Nigerian oil industry since 1956, and we're talking about corporations such as Royal Dutch Shell, Chevron, Exxon Mobil, Total, and BP, and others are extremely angry with the current administration of Umaru Yar Adua of Nigeria because of a recent deal that they have signed with the People's Republic of China that's valued at approximately $50 billion. What has transpired is that at a recent China-Africa summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, that took place just last month, China pledged a tremendous amount of investment in Africa, but in Nigeria in particular in relationship to the oil industry. Now, this new deal, a proposed deal between the current Nigerian administration and China, requires the passage of a petroleum bill that's right now before the Nigerian legislature. And the fact that this bill may very well pass has caused a considerable amount of consternation on the part of these major U.S. firms. For example, the Daily Trust newspaper in Nigeria on December 21st reported that Western oil companies may not renew their operational licenses in Nigeria as Royal Dutch Shell launched a shakeup of its operations in Nigeria by offering oil fields valued at $5 billion for sale. This article continues by saying that this, according to sources, and coming owing to their dissatisfaction with the handling of the oil sector by the Nigerian government. They also are concerned about the deregulation policy and how it will work. While the National Assembly is said to have promised to pass the petroleum bill into law before the end of this month, the date for this takeoff of deregulation is unknown. Royal Dutch Shell, ExxonMobil, Total, and Chevron, which have dominated Nigeria's energy sector for decades, have criticized the Petroleum Ministry Bill, that's the PIB, saying it could threaten billions of dollars of investment if it goes ahead in its current form. Sources also say they are also concerned about Nigeria's new oil ally, China. China has offered to invest $50 billion for acquiring 6 billion barrels of oil reserves in the country. So these are some of the variables that are going on within the context of this incident that occurred in Detroit on December 25th. So, and there are other issues as well, but if you want to explore some of these two issues, we can at this point.
Yeah, and it seems, I mean, you bring up some real good points, and what I was thinking also was that this incident would serve as a precipitator for the U.S., or would precipitate the U.S. to really continue to accelerate their plans for the militarization, the U.S.-based militarization of different parts of Africa, known as of AFRICOM, and you know, by saying, you know, that, you know, we know that, you know, that these, you know, terror cells are now starting to manifest themselves and to metastasize in different parts of Africa. We see the Shabab group in Somalia, and now, you know, and we see the unrest, the so-called unrest that's going on in different parts of Nigeria, and the way they sell it, they often, you know, understandably from their perspective, put things in a very out of context, you know, way. The same way when the whole situation with the pirates and off the coast of Somalia, they didn't tell you that, you know, that that European ships were dumping toxic waste off the coast. They didn't give you that backdrop, and that many of those so-called pirates were defending themselves, their region, and their people. You know, they don't tell you about, you know, like what you just said. You talked about Royal Dutch Shell, Total, and how these, you know, as well as Chevron, and these corporations have been committing environmental terrorism in different parts of Nigeria, where you have the whole MEND movement, you know, doing different things to disturb their work, so that, you know, that more money is, you know, to put pressure on the government so that more money is distributed to the people where that oil, in the ground where that oil lies, as well as to stop these folks who have been committing environmental terrorism. We saw that, you know, how that New York federal court awarded you know, the families of people like what's the brother's name, that
Kim Sarawiwa.
Kim Sarawiwa, yeah. And so,
yeah,
we see that, and you know, those types of things happen, and it's never put into any kind of context. But basically, you know, my point is that it seems that, to me, the first thing that popped into my head was that when they started talking about, and they had that jerk, that friggin' bum, Peter King, the congressman from New York, they had him on, and he was just pushing this whole thing. Oh, you know, we see the lax security in Nigeria, and he was talking on CNN. He was like, you know, this is a region where there's a lot of militants popping up, this, that, and the other. And so he didn't say anything about AFRICOM, but I could just see the whole AFRICOM issue starting to be, you know, to be something that is going to be more and more prevalent and going to be more accelerated on the part of these imperialist forces to get AFRICOM into the U.S. so that they can secure strategic mineral resources that the U.S. needs, you know, because as Dick Cheney said, when the whole Iraq invasion occurred, you know, he point blank, you know, mentioned that, you know, that we have to secure U.S. interests in that region. You know what I'm saying? So did you see that as also another factor, the AFRICOM connection?
Yeah, most definitely, because President Obama has beefed up the Africa Command, U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM operations on the continent. In fact, they conducted war games earlier this year in the Gulf of Guinea and also in the Central West African oil-rich nation of Gabon. Mm. So it's already taking place, and this is taking place within the context of the growing role of Africa in supplying oil reserves to the United States. Nigeria, for example, now, as a result of the unrest in the Niger Delta and also because of the severe economic crisis that hit Nigeria earlier this year, is no longer the Africa's number one producer of oil. Angola has taken that role during the year of 2009. In fact, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, just recently held its international summit in Angola. So Nigeria is also in a position right now where it's facing an extreme amount of economic turmoil. In fact, the banking industry there almost collapsed several months ago. The Central Bank of Nigeria had to step in to bail out the top five banking institutions inside the country because of the same similar problems that occurred here in the United States during 2008. And that crisis did not receive any attention in the media here in the United States. Also, we have to recognize that the president has a political crisis going on in Nigeria because the president of that country, Umaru Musa Yar'Adua, is ill. He's currently in Saudi Arabia undergoing medical treatment. He has not been in the country now for well over a month. The elements inside the country that are calling for his resignation and the appointment of a new head of state because they're saying that his health crisis does not allow him to effectively lead this major West African country, which has the largest population of any other country on the African continent. So we also have this pressure against Nigeria, both domestically as well as internationally. And, of course, with the threats that are being made against the Nigerian government by the leading multinational oil firms, we can surmise that there's an attempt either to pressure the Nigerian government to back away from this massive oil deal with the People's Republic of China, or the country is going to be extremely vulnerable to some type of effort aimed at regime change that will, of course, be initiated by the United States. You know, this is inevitable. We've seen this take place in the past, and there's no reason to believe that it's not going on right now. They cannot afford to lose access to Nigerian oil reserves in terms of the desire to dominate that industry by the United States. Also in Ghana, which is a country in the same West Africa region, they have just discovered oil there. Off the coast of the country, and there's a lot of competition and jockeying that's going on between the Western-based multinational oil firms and China. They're trying to block China as well from involvement in the exploitation and exploration of oil that has recently been discovered in the West African nation of Ghana. So Africa is becoming more and more important, more and more strategic in regard to the supply of oil to the United States and these Western imperialist countries. So all of this must be looked at within this particular context. For example, this Daily Trust article, which I quoted from earlier, it quotes also a spokesperson for President Umaru Musa Yar'Adua, Emmanuel Egboha, who says that, quote, Chinese people are not buying fields. They want to acquire reserves in Nigeria. Specifically, the application was to acquire reserves of 6 billion barrels, which we are currently discussing. They are prepared to spend as much as $50 billion, unquote. Now, this is a major, major development economically. The article in the Daily Trust from December 31st also goes on to say, and I quote, spokesman of the Shell Petroleum Development Company, company, the SPDC, Precious Okolobo, however, said he could not comment on the matter when contacted on the phone yesterday. This was December 20th. But the general manager, Government and Public Affairs of Chevron Nigeria Limited, Femi Odumabo, told this paper, the Daily Trust, in a telephone interview that his company and other multinational oil companies are currently engaging in discussion with the federal government and its relevant agencies on the petroleum industry bill and the deregulation policy. He did not comment on whether or not his company and other multinational oil companies would not renew their operating license due to the issue at hand. Quote, discussions on the issue are currently ongoing with the federal government. We are engaging in discussion with relevant government officials and agencies, unquote. Public affairs advisor of ExxonMobil, Mr. Yemi Fakayiho, could not be reached on phone for comment. Some provisions of the petroleum industry bill specifically specify that the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, which actually controls the oil industry in Nigeria, main joint ventures with Shell, Chevron, Total, ExxonMobil, and Agip, would also be restructured into independent companies with new management when the bill becomes law, leaving the companies with much uncertainty on how the new companies will operate, who will manage them, and how profits will be shared. At the public hearing for the bill in August of 2009, Managing Director of Chevron Nigeria Limited, Andre Bothrop, said, quote, some of the provisions in the bill are still open to interpretation. It is very important that we clarify that bill before it is codified, unquote. So there are some serious discussions that are going on vis-a-vis the oil industry in Nigeria. And the United States is attempting and has attempted over the last several decades to dominate the oil industry internationally. We can see in Iraq the principal motivation behind the invasion and occupation of Iraq was, of course, the control of Iraq's extremely large oil reserves that had been estimated to be the largest in the world. And right now, as a result of the invasion and occupation, the oil industry in Iraq has been privatized. We also see a lot of focus being placed on Iran. Any demonstration, any opposition activity in Iran that takes place is given banner headline status in the United States. They are deliberately attempting to destabilize the Iranian government. And why? Because, first of all, Iran had a revolution some 30 years ago against a U.S.-backed dictatorship under the Shah, a very repressive regime that did the bidding of U.S. imperialism. Iran, too, is a major oil producer in the international market. We can look at Venezuela. We can look at Colombia. In Latin America, these countries as well are major oil producers. Sudan, which they have been targeting for regime change for the last several years, under the guise that they're very concerned about the civil war taking place in the western part of the country of in the region of Darfur. They're claiming that they have concerns about human rights violations there, but Sudan is a major oil producer, and of course, the U.S. has been principally excluded from the exploitation of oil in Sudan over 10 years, and the major concessions for the oil industry in Sudan are controlled by the People's Republic of China. 80% of the oil concessions are controlled by China, and the other 20% are mainly controlled by other countries in the Middle East and Asia. So we can see oil, once again, playing a key role as a motivating factor in the U.S. foreign policy.
Definitely. And I wanted to switch to something else that I found when this first started happening about a week and a half ago, when these letters started to come out about African American scholars writing signing their names onto this letter to oppose racism and the allegations of racism in Cuba, and you had a number of U.S.-based scholars signing their names to this letter, and one of the first things that I thought of is that and I definitely love your take on this, because I know that you're a scholar in terms of the struggle for liberation and independence in Southern Africa, and the large role that Cuba and Fidel Castro and Ernesto Che Guevara played in providing, you know, troops and logistical support to, you know, the likes of Namibia, Mozambique, Angola, South Africa, to help them establish and fight for their independence, you know. But I, you know, it was just kind of odd to see these African American scholars sign this letter, and right here in the belly of the beast, United States of America, the epicenter of capitalism, you know, in my estimation, the epicenter of racism, you know, or I should say structural and institutional racism. I mean, it's such an institution here in the U.S. that most people don't even see, you know, the structural and institutional racism and white supremacy that occurs on a not a weekly basis, a yearly basis, but a daily basis. It's been woven into the fabric of U.S. You know, racism is a part of is very much a part of the fabric of the U.S. And so instead of putting their efforts together and signing a letter and sending it to the U.S. you know, government, the Congress, administration, and you know, asking to hold hearings based around structural institutional racism and such as things that take people's lives, such as police brutality, which has continued to rear its ugly head in cities like Detroit, New York, you know, D.C., Baltimore, and so forth. They want to turn their attention to Cuba of all places. And so I wanted to, you know, to get your take, if you could talk about the pieces. You wrote some, you know, a couple brilliant pieces that I was very happy to see you write, and I sent out to all my networks, you know, within the past, you know, couple weeks. And so if you could could you give us a backdrop of this story and what, you know, what is your perspective on these so-called scholars, you know, taking up their, you know, joining forces to really try to put pressure on the, you know, the Cuban government rather than the U.S. government?
Yeah, we have to look at the context in which this is taking place. It's very interesting that right now, when we have the unveiling of the domestic and foreign policy of the Obama administration, which is really has turned out to be a continuation of what the Bush administration has done in regard to Cuba, in regard to Latin America and other parts of the world, we see these 60 African-American scholars signing this statement that was largely drafted by Carlos Moore, who's a Cuban, anti-Castro Cuban, anti-communist, who has been working for decades to discredit and consequently overthrow the Cuban Revolution. Now, you know, this recent statement that was issued on race relations, in my opinion, is not representative of the opinion of progressive forces within the African community in the United States, many of whom have for years supported the revolution in Cuba. These individuals who signed the statement, many of whom are academics, have never really supported the revolutionary domestic and foreign policy of the Cuban government anyway. You know, just judging from past press accounts related to the origin of the statement, as I mentioned before, Carlos Moore, a longtime anti-Castro Cuban who happens to be black, has for years sought to turn African-Americans against the revolution in Cuba. And he, of course, it has come out as behind this recent statement. Many of them, I think, the individuals who signed the statement are confused about not only the character of race relations in the United States, but also in Cuba itself. Now, Cuba has never said that they have totally eliminated racism within the island. Cuba itself was a former colony of Spain. They had slavery in Cuba that was a vicious, exploitative, and racist system.
Right.
The racism in Cuba was institutionalized under slavery. In fact, slavery in Cuba ended 13 years after slavery was eliminated in the United States. It wasn't ended until 1878, after the War of Independence in Cuba. And even after that, racism still continued. When the U.S. Launched a war against Spain for the control of Spanish colonies, which is known as the so-called Spanish-American War. In actuality, it was not the Spanish-American War. In actuality, it was a war of imperialism between two imperialist states, Spain and the United States, to take control of Spanish colonies in Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Philippines. Racism continued in all of those geopolitical regions. In fact, the Platt Amendment, which was a document that was passed by the U.S. Congress in 1901, 1902, actually institutionalized the continuation of U.S. colonialism and imperialism in Cuba. It also established the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, which still exists today, despite the fact that Cuba is a revolutionary country. They still have a U.S. military base on their island, and the U.S. is refusing to leave that base. And on that base today, we have hundreds of so-called enemy combatants who are being held there, have been held there during the course of the Bush administration for supposedly being terrorists who are interested in carrying out attacks against the United States. So this is the case. And Cuba, of course, overthrew the U.S.-backed Batista regime in 1959. And they have made tremendous progress in regard to fighting racism on the island. They have also given tremendous support to revolutions in Africa and around the world. In fact, their support of the revolutions in Guinea-Bissau, in Angola, in Guinea-Conakry, and other parts of Africa has been essential in terms of destroying settler colonialism on the African continent. In fact, in Angola, the Cubans sent approximately 250,000 of its own people to fight against the South African Defense Forces that were backed up by the United States, by the Central Intelligence Agency. It actually broke the back of apartheid in Southern Africa during the 1970s and 1980s that led to the independence, the total independence of Angola, the independence of Namibia, as well as the independence of South Africa. So we owe a tremendous amount of debt to the Cuban Revolution for this work. Yet, this current episode, which was actually resulted from a domestic legal issue inside Cuba itself, where they are battling corruption within the country there, and these intellectuals have raised this criminal case to the level of civil rights, and it's not a civil rights question in Cuba. Cuba has undergone a revolution. It's a question of strengthening and enhancing the revolution in Cuba and also defending that revolution, which has been under attack by U.S. imperialism over the last five decades. Cuba is still under attack. It was invaded in 1961 at the Bay of Pigs. There's been tremendous amounts of covert operations against Cuba since 1959, and those covert operations are still going on right now. They're supporting dissidents inside the country. So anybody that would issue a statement critical of the Cuban government on the basis of racism has to look at the context in which they're raising these criticisms. And they can only inevitably work with the United States to further isolate Cuba. Now, when Obama came in, he made it appear as if he was going to work towards the normalization of relations with Cuba. In fact, there was a delegation from the Congressional Black Caucus headed by Bob Lee that actually went down to Cuba earlier this year to hold discussions with the Cuban government about the possibility of normalization, or at least a move towards normalization. Yet, relatively nothing has been done. There was a lifting of a travel ban to Cuban Americans, however they are defined, and also the repatriation of funds, well, the sending of funds from Cuban Americans to Cuba. But beyond that, nothing fundamentally has been done. In fact, U.S. interference in the Cuban affairs of Cuban people has continued and even escalated over the last year under the Obama administration. In fact, if we look clearly at a lot of the U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America, it has been heavily anti-Cuban. Obama announced just recently that he has is going to assist the reactionary government in Colombia to construct a number of military bases in that country, one of the countries that is still closely allied with the United States that's fighting with FARC, the armed forces of Colombia, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia that's attempting, a socialist liberation movement that's attempting to overthrow the counter-revolutionary government in Colombia. And Colombia is on the border with Venezuela, which is another country that's been under attack by the United States. Now, why is the Obama administration working with the Colombian government to build military bases there? This is clearly an act of provocation against the Venezuelan and Bolivian as well as Cuban revolutions. There's also been other electoral campaigns that have won in South America that have moved societies towards the left. For example, in Chile and Argentina, in Paraguay, as well as in Uruguay and also in Ecuador. So there's a real threat to U.S. hegemony in Latin America. Yet the Obama administration, rather than supporting the popular will of the people in Latin America, is supporting Colombia, which is the third largest recipient of U.S. military and foreign aid in general in the entire world. Israel is number one. Egypt is number two. And Colombia is number three. And Colombia is known for killing and kidnapping trade union leaders. So there's no way they can say that they're defending democracy in Colombia by sending U.S. troops there, by sending U.S. aid there, and also working right now to build seven more military bases in Colombia that's right on the border with Venezuela. So we have to look at this statement within this particular context. And unfortunately, a lot of progressive African-American organizations and individuals have written a letter, two letters. One was written by the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Guinea-Conakry, in response to this provocation. And another was put out by a group of supporters, African-American supporters, of the Cuban Revolution that included people like Sam Anderson and Rosemary Neely out of New York and others. I had the honor of signing that statement. And many other people have signed that statement. So we have to look at this, you know, this so-called attack on Cuba, you know, in terms of civil rights and racism within this particular context. And let me just mention that from a recent article that was published by the BBC, which is the British government news service. And, of course, we know Britain is closely allied with the United States. Now, this article was published on December the 20th, so it's less than a week ago. It says, the title of the article is Colombia Beefs Up Border Forces. It says the Colombian government has announced it is building a new military base on its border with Venezuela, and has activated six new airborne battalions. Relations between the two nations are at a historic low, with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez already telling his generals to prepare for war. He moved 15,000 more troops up to the border, accusing Colombia and its ally, the U.S., of planning an attack on Venezuela. A BBC correspondent says the potential for conflict is heightened. Colombian Defense Minister Gabriel Silva announced the formation of a new base in La Guaira, in the north, near the Venezuelan border. At the same time, the Colombian Army activated the new airborne battalions, which are equipped with U.S. helicopters. The helicopter fleet, made up mainly of Black Hawks, now number 120. These are U.S. helicopters, making the Colombian Army Air Corps the best equipped and most experienced in Latin America, the BBC's Jeremy McDermott in Colombia says. President Chavez has criticized the pact announced last week, allowing U.S. troops to use several bases in Colombia. Mr. Silva said that the new base would have up to 1,000 soldiers. It would, he added, also have a care facility for indigenous Wayuu people who live in the area. Since Venezuelans were told by Mr. Chavez to prepare for war and the Venezuelan army started blowing up bridges that link the two nations, Colombia has been overhauling its defense strategy. Until now, this strategy has been geared almost exclusively to fighting the country's 45-year Marxist insurgency that's led by FARC. With the increasing buildup of the military on both sides of the border, the potential for conflict is heightened, particularly when one considers 2,000 rebels in the border regions prepared for a fight between the two nations. This is according to the BBC in a dispatch on December 20th. So we can see very clearly that U.S. administration policy in Latin America is fueling tensions to the point of almost an all-out war between Venezuela and Colombia. So it's just a continuation and even an intensification of the same imperialist policies that we saw under the Bush administration that's being carried out under President Barack Obama. So, and you know, we could talk about many, many other issues that are going on right now in Latin America as well.
Yeah, and I mean, the point that you bring up when you, we're talking about Cuba and other regions and you know, Latin America, such as the Chavez administration in Venezuela, and also, I can't talk about Chavez without also mentioning Evo Morales and their eloquent words at the this past Copenhagen 15 summit in Denmark, and they had some very strong words for the U.S. That came in there trying to use its might and its so-called like clout to issue this bullcrap basic ultimatum,
yeah.
In terms of what so if you could talk about that, because that's something that really hasn't gotten a lot of play in terms of what the U.S. owes developing nations, because developed communities or countries such as the U.S. have been the ones that have provided this world environment with the most environmental destruction, based off of their large in industries and just rapacious greed around just consumption from meat to cars to gas. And so I loved what Morales said, and I love what Hugo Chavez said, as well as other folks like the sister from India, Vandana Shiva. But what is your take on this piece of crap ultimatum that Hillary Clinton and then President Barack Obama issued while they're out there, and coincidentally, a couple days after he basically justified, saying that there's a justification for war as he accepted the undeserved Nobel Peace Prize, because if folks like like himself get this award, such as Henry Kissinger and Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, I mean this is a piece of crap award. But what is your take around this whole environmental destruction that's being carried out and the U.S.'s stance in Copenhagen?
The entire international community was appalled at the behavior of the United States at the recently held COP15 climate change summit in Copenhagen. It's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And the whole operation was designed to eliminate the Kyoto Protocol, which was developed during the late 1990s. Which mandated the curbing of greenhouse gases, CO2 emissions, which are causing a tremendous amount of environmental damage throughout the world. And Africa has been extremely affected by CO2. The whole operation, the role of the United States was to eliminate the Kyoto Protocol. And in fact, they came up with a draft document would have, in fact, eliminated the Kyoto Protocol. And that was the whole aim of the United States' role. In fact, I wrote an article on this and the role of the African countries, which was commendable. I mean, the fact that if we look at the economic crisis and how it's affected the African continent and the pressure that Africa is under right now by the United States, Britain, and France, and these other European imperialist countries, the fact that they would have the courage and the fortitude to rise to the occasion to challenge the United States and these other Western imperialist countries is really heroic. But in this article, it says that, quote, African countries at the COP15 Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen led a walkout for several hours on December 14th to protest the efforts of the United States, Britain, and other imperialist countries and their allies to sidestep responsibility for the worsening impact of carbon dioxide emissions. The increasing concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere has caused climate change that threatens the total collapse of agricultural productions on the African continent. The walkout could have derailed the entire conference. Heads of state from 120 countries were scheduled to arrive in Copenhagen during the week of December 14th. Developing nations in Asia and Latin America, along with the People's Republic of China, joined the African state in accusing the summit's Danish president of refusing to allow discussion on major issues that affect the overwhelming majority of people on the planet. Developing countries refused to participate in the working group that was scheduled to begin on December 14th, which was the second week of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. The African bloc, along with the group of 77 developing countries, demanded universal adherence to the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, which sets goals for emission standards and the reduction of CO2 gases by 2012. These emissions result from the burning of oil, gas, and coal. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps solar heat, causing a rise in the Earth's atmosphere. Atmospheric scientists have predicted that if no serious actions are taken over the next decade, the planet will warm significantly and there will be an escalation of drought, floods, and storms, along with rising sea levels that will bring famine to billions of people throughout the world. A United Nations report, an environmental report, has indicated that approximately 60 million people have suffered the effects of 245 natural disasters just this year alone. More than 90% of these serious weather-related events have been amplified by climate change. African states have made the case that their region is the hardest hit by pollutants generated by the industrialized states, whose governments refuse to agree on limits to emissions. At the same time, these governments are unwilling to provide compensation to developing countries for the damage caused to the environment. So this is the backdrop to the climate change conference in Copenhagen. And it's really amazing that what we've seen in terms of what has been happening recently in East Africa, where we've had monumental, unprecedented drought, the death of livestock, the destruction of crops, and in all of these countries, Somalia, Ethiopia, as well as Kenya, there have been huge food deficits. For example, the news agency of Nigeria issued a report just recently, and it said, quote, according to the news agency of Nigeria, Africa is the worst hit when it comes to global emissions. We are going to Copenhagen with one voice, and our position is that the developed countries should pay us $50 billion in the short term. Our requisition also is that in 2015, the compensation should be increased to $250 billion. The African Union's Presidential Commission has agreed on this position unanimously, saying that the continent, which generates only 4% of the world's carbon emissions, has been the most severely affected by climate change. In addition to compensation through funding, Africa is also demanding technology transfers that would foster the replacement of outmoded machinery. In making its case for compensation from the Western industrialized countries, The Monitor, which is a newspaper published in Uganda, wrote in an editorial on December 14th that, quote, the entire East African region has, for example, this year witnessed extensive drought with crop failure and livestock death commonplace in semi-arid areas. Secondly, Africa is home to a big percentage of the world's natural rainforest, which helps stabilize climate by sucking carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases methane, nitrous oxide, perfluorocarbons, hydrofluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride, unquote. The Monitor editorial continues by stressing that, quote, we must be compensated for each tree standing. Modalities of compensation should be a key item on the agenda in Copenhagen. The USA, the principal culprit, must be at the forefront of efforts to both save the environment and to pay reparations, unquote. And what actually transpired at the summit, which was a farce, you know, most people who were at the conference said it was a farce. There were tens of thousands of people who demonstrated outside. They were attacked by the Danish riot police. And inside, Obama showed up. Well, first Hillary Clinton showed up the day before the last day of the proceedings and said that, you know, they had to accept what the U.S. wanted. Then Obama showed up and pulled together about five countries, including Brazil and South Africa and a few others, and said they had to follow the dictates of the United States. He attacked China, saying that they needed to have more transparency. And it's interesting to point out that China has gone further than any other major state in curbing greenhouse gases. In fact, they're doing more than any other country to address the question of climate change inside the People's Republic of China. And then he went out and held a press conference saying that there had been an agreement, when in fact there was no such agreement. And even the South African government, who sat in on the meeting, the environmental minister there, a couple of days later, said the entire summit was a farce. So, you know, this is doing nothing to enhance the status of the United States around the world. Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, said in a statement in Copenhagen that he actually felt sorry for the people of the United States because many people in this country felt by voting for Barack Obama that there was going to be some effort to address the concrete economic conditions and social conditions that are worsening in the United States, but that apparently Obama is following the same imperialist policies that the United States has carried out for the last several centuries.
Yeah. I can't let you leave without also touching on, since you just, you know, brought it up, you know, you mentioned these policies that have been picked up, you know, willingly by Obama and his administration of minions. I don't know who's, you know, who's wagging who, but clearly they're locking step with one another. But I'd love to get your take on this huge, you know, since, you know, you mentioned Hugo Chavez said he felt sorry for, you know, regular everyday Americans. And, you know, I really feel sorry for the tens of millions of people in this country who have no health insurance and because of that have no health care whatsoever each year, you know, and 44,000 plus of those people die each year because of lack of health insurance and lack of health care. You know, if you could touch on the role that this most capitalist state, you know, United States of America, and has played, you know, how capitalism has played in this, how it's been the motivator and the I guess the engine that moves this machine, you know, in regards to things like healthcare, you know, healthcare reform, and also just like this the loss, because you know these Democrats are championing this as if this is a victory. I mean the damn public option, which was a compromise in and of itself, far away from, you know, the original goal of universal or you know, our state-sponsored single-payer health care. I mean, so that was a compromise in and of itself, but that's totally off the table. And now you have the American populace having to buy a crappy product, you know, from these just awfully corrupt insurance companies such as Cigna, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, United, you know, and go on and on. And they're the ones that have won. They're the ones that have won. What's your take on this whole thing? Because I know that in Detroit, where, you know, no other city has a higher unemployment rate, I know people are suffering there, not just like mentally but physically. And those people, if they're out of work, they most certainly, I know, many of them have no health insurance and therefore have no health care. What's your whole take on this thing?
Well, Obama, even when he was in the U.S. Senate, had said that he was in favor of single-payer health care. And, however, when he got in office, he changed his position completely. And it has to be pointed out that the United States is the only major industrialized state that does not have a universal health insurance program. Right across the border in Canada, which is also a capitalist country, which is also an industrialized country, everyone there has a right to health insurance. They have a very advanced universal health insurance policy in Canada. So if it can work there, if it can work in Britain, if it can work in France, if it can work in other industrialized, Western industrialized capitalist countries, why can't it work in the United States? That's because the health industry and the insurance industry are so dominant in the United States that they will not allow any of these politicians to pass or even discuss, to even have a serious debate on the question of universal health care. John Conyers, who was a veteran U.S. congressman from the city of Detroit, had developed a bill, H.R. 676, that had the endorsement of dozens of people within the U.S. House of Representatives as well as the Senate. And instead of discussing his bill for passage, they developed another bill and totally ignored all the work that Conyers had done over the last several years in terms of developing a single-payer health insurance program. So it shows very clearly that the Obama administration is working at the behest of the insurance, pharmaceutical, as well as private health hospital industry in this country. And the fact of the matter is that anywhere between 48 million and 75 million people during the course of a year do not have health coverage in the United States, which is touts itself as being the most wealthiest nation in the world. I mean, that's a gross violation of human rights of the majority of people in the United States, because when people don't have health insurance, this in fact affects the entire population, because when they have to go to a hospital, somebody's got to pay for that. They have to go to an emergency room, and those costs are going to be passed on to people who do have health insurance. So the society as a whole, in terms of the working people in society, are going to pay for that. Plus, when you have a population that's not healthy, this affects the productivity of the economic well-being of the country. So it affects the country overall. Now, this bill that they supposedly have agreed upon, they claim will ensure another 30 million people in the United States. But what about the other 18 million who have no health insurance? They're not even talking about these people. And the notion that the government should not be responsible for providing health insurance to people is absolutely absurd. How can the Congress have the nerve to make such a statement when, in fact, they themselves have health insurance programs that are paid for by the U.S. taxpayer? And they have one of the best health insurance programs in the entire country, and it's paid for by people in the United States who pay their salaries. So it's just absolutely outrageous that they would be allowed to get away with this. But the fact that the media is controlled by the corporate community, this is never even discussed. So I think it's a travesty of justice. And we still don't know what the outcome of this health care bill is actually going to be in its final form. They claimed victory and they went on holiday, but they still have to work out the details in the House of Representatives as well as the Senate. So we're following this very, very closely to see actually what's going to take place. But the fact of the matter is that people are suffering immensely as a result of the crisis in healthcare in the United States. And it's not just the unemployed and the poor. Many people who work every day don't have health insurance in the United States. More and more corporations are eliminating healthcare benefits for their workers and for the families of their workers. Also, even people who do have health insurance, they're underinsured. A lot of procedures are not covered. Or they're poorly covered. So they really can't get the health care that they need, to address the health concerns that they have. So it's really a travesty of justice. And then we look at a country like Cuba, a socialist country, which is considered a third world poor country, 90 miles off the coast of the United States. They have one of the most advanced healthcare systems in the world. They have the highest doctor-patient ratio in the world. They produce so many doctors that they could even export doctors to other countries in Latin America and even to Africa to provide healthcare free of charge to poor people. They have pioneered all types of healthcare procedures in Latin America as well as on the African continent. In fact, they educate thousands of healthcare professionals every year in Cuba at the Latin American School of Medicine, even people from the United States. There's a scholarship program right now that African Americans and other national oppressed groups in the United States are studying in Cuba to become physicians. In fact, there are two people from Detroit. One woman who's an attorney here in Detroit, her daughter right now is studying medicine at the Latin American School of Medicine in Cuba. During the Katrina disaster in 2005, Cuba volunteered to send 1,500 of their physicians to the Gulf area to work with the people there. And the Bush administration refused to allow these people in the country. These people were willing to come to provide medical attention based upon the grave humanitarian crisis that existed in the Gulf, and they turned them down. Because you know why they turned them down? Bush said, well, we're a wealthy country. We don't need the help of anybody else. The Venezuelans also offered to help by sending in oil shipments. They had ships ready to come to the Gulf to provide oil, heating resources, and other material assistance to the people in the Gulf. Also, France had volunteered to send assistance. And Bush said, well, we're a rich country. We don't need the assistance of anybody else. But the reason why they didn't want those Cuban doctors to come to U.S. soil, because it would expose the decades of lies that had been told by the U.S. government, by the U.S. ruling class about the character of Cuban society, about the veracity of the Cuban Revolution, about the tremendous advances they have made in the area of science and medical services. And it would have been a boon to U.S.-Cuba relations, and also would have exposed the many, many falsehoods that have been told about Cuba through the corporate media in this country. That was the real reason why they didn't want the Cuban doctors coming into the United States. So, yes, we think this is a national scandal that we have tens of millions of people in the United States who don't have health insurance, and it appears as if this trend is going to continue into the unforeseeable future.
Right. Brother Abiyomi, before we leave, could I ask you a question that has to do, if you could give us an update on the current situation based on the murder of the Detroit imam, Luqman Amin Abdullah. And if you could give, like, the listeners, maybe some, you know, probably many folks don't know about what happened to this brother, how he was murdered by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. If you could give, like, a brief backdrop about this brother and what happened to him, and where is the case now? Like, I know that there has been some community pressure to investigate the proceedings, you know, and backdrop around this this raid that eventually led to his death, and it was eerily reminiscent to what happened to Mark Clark and Brother Fred Hampton.
Well, yes, this is a major cover-up that's going on of the murder of Imam Luqman Amin Abdullah. One of the organizations that I work with, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against Justice, organized two mass demonstrations in opposition to the FBI murder of this leading African-American religious leader who had worked for decades in the community on the west side to feed the poor, to shelter the homeless, to provide guidance to wayward African-American youth, had never been cited for any type of criminal activity, had carried out a soup kitchen, which they still have, even in the aftermath of his death. His family and mosque members are still feeding people every week, every Sunday, at their mosque here on the west side of Detroit. And Imam Lewis had his mosque, the Masjid al-Haq, infiltrated by the FBI over the last 2.5 years. They sent informants into the organization trying to foment criminal activity. They, in fact, even offered him money to engage in so-called terrorist activities. When the Super Bowl was here in 2005, one FBI informant had approached him and offered him $5,000 to carry out some type of operation against the participants in the Super Bowl. And he told them clearly, and this is in the FBI's 44-page criminal complaint that was issued right in the aftermath of his assassination. He said that he was not about carrying out any action that would harm innocent people. And they tried to label him as a terrorist, linking him to the former SNCC and Black Panther, Brad Brown, Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, who is now serving a life sentence in federal prison because he was falsely convicted for the murder of a Georgia Fulton County deputy sheriff. He was lured. Imam Lukman and some of his family members and followers were lured to a warehouse in Dearborn under the guise that they would be paid $300 to unload some goods from a warehouse. When they got there, the FBI fired tear gas into the warehouse, sent an attack dog in, specifically targeted Imam Lukman. He was shot at least 18 times and handcuffed and put on a stretcher. And this is what happened. 10 of his followers have been indicted on spurious criminal charges, one of whom is his son. They just held a fundraiser for his son a couple of weeks ago in downtown Detroit that drew the attention of a number of hip-hop artists from around the country, including Professor Griff, who was here in Detroit. I had an opportunity to meet him for the first time at the club downtown where this fundraiser took place. But the cover-up continues to go on, and one good example of it is that the autopsy report, they're refusing to release it. And this is a clear tip-off that they're trying to cover up the character of this assassination. It's being suppressed, and even the corporate media right now, the Detroit Free Press came out about 3 weeks ago calling for an independent investigation into his murder. I mean, this is remarkable, considering how bad the coverage of the Detroit Free Press was in the aftermath of his assassination. Numerous organizations have come out and condemned the assassination and called for an independent investigation. The Congress of Arab American Organizations has called for an independent investigation. The Council of American Islamic Relations have called for an independent investigation. The Michigan Coalition for Human Rights, which I am the chairman of the board of that human rights organization, has passed a resolution calling for an independent investigation. So the cover-up is being exposed, and I think that this incident in Detroit involving Farouk Abdul-Muttalib is also connected with this assassination to intensify the cover-up. Because here in Detroit, the FBI assassinated this leading African-American imam on October 28th. And the fact of the matter is that the investigation into this incident is being obstructed on several levels, including the refusal of the authorities to release the autopsy of the slain Islamic leader, and also the fact that if they can link Detroit with this purported Islamic threat of terrorism, and it also justifies the escalation of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Obama went on December 1st to West Point Military Academy and announced he was going to be sending another 30,000 U.S. troops into Afghanistan, over and above the will of the majority of American people who don't see any benefit whatsoever of escalating the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Central Asia as a whole. But if they can develop this boogeyman of Islamic terrorism in the United States, then they could utilize that as a justification for intensifying the war. Do you know that the American defense budget now is larger than it's ever been in the history of the country? Obama, his administration has increased the defense budget by tens of millions of dollars. Now it's almost $800 billion a year that's being spent on defense. by the United States taxpayers when, in fact, we have an unemployment rate that is high as it has been since the Great Depression, that we have millions of people who are not even counted in the unemployment figures that are issued every month by the U.S. Government, that foreclosure rates are slated to increase in 2010, that we have the closure of hundreds of K-12 schools throughout the length and breadth of the United States, that at universities, there are massive cutbacks that are going on. Tuition rates are increasing in California to the tune of 33%. At universities all over the country, faculty members are being fired. Tuition is being increased. Departments are being eliminated and consolidated. And instead of this being the focus of discussion by the corporate media, all we hear every day and all day long is Al-Qaeda, 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 terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. And if they can deflect the American people's attention away from the fact that trillions upon trillions of dollars have been stolen from them just over the last few years through the dissolution of their pension funds, the elimination of their jobs, the elimination of their health care benefits, then, of course, they can try to convince the American people that their real enemy is Islamic terrorism and not the ruling class in this country, not the barons of Wall Street, and not the Pentagon, who is spending hundreds of billions of dollars of their taxpayer money, but a few hundred Al-Qaeda operatives. Then, of course, they can bring about a situation where people will be confused and anesthetized and consequently paralyzed and will not work in their own interests and will, in fact, work in the interests of U.S. capitalism and imperialism.
Right. Thank you so much, man, for that insight. And thanks so much for joining us again and providing insight and perspective and actually and you know, information and news that we, as I said before you came on, to the listeners, that we cannot rely on the corporate media to provide us with critical analysis of geopolitical issues as well as issues that occur within the stolen and artificial borders that make up the United States of America. And thank you so much for providing so much insight once again to Your World News and all of our listeners, and we look forward to doing it again. But before we leave, could you give the listeners your website as well as your email address if anyone wants to connect with you and to reach out with you to perhaps, you know, discuss or get some more insights or even perhaps bring you into to their organization for a talk like you did when you came into University of Maryland and spoke to the students at University of Maryland College Park right outside Washington, D.C., and gave a two-hour in-depth discussion and back-and-forth dialogue with students as well as faculty and staff members of the University of Maryland.
Well, yes, and I want to thank you again for that invitation to the University of Maryland at College Park. It was very rewarding, and, you know, I really consider that to be a high point of 2009 in regard to the work that I'm involved in through the Pan-African Newswire. People who want to get more information about the Pan-African Newswire, they can log on to our blog at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If people want to get on our listserv, they can write us at our email address. That's at PANW, at Pan-African Newswire, PANW at africamail.com. That's PANW at africamail.com.
Thank you once again, and thanks to listeners, and once again, brother, comrade, elder, and friend, Abiyomi Ezekwe, thank you, and I hope that 2010 brings us more prosperity than we got in 2009. But you know, as you've said so many times before, we have to fight for it because this government, this administration, and the imperialist powers that be are not going to concede anything without the people demanding it. So, you know, knowledge,
yes,
power.
Thank you so much. And 2010 will definitely be a year of struggle.
All right. Thank you. And
thank you
take
so
care.
Much.
Until next time, this is Solomon for Your World News.
Let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
It goes red, black, and green. Flag on the back of my whip, rolling so clean. Bossing Public Enemy, X-Clan, and WA. Saying fuck the police like Dr. Dre. Feel like revolutionaries, fighting the system, writing the dissim. Cause one day I was enlightened by wisdom. Saw the world for what it's worth, and my life on this earth. And realized the humble paths and took strides on it first. But soon all the scenery got trifling at worst. I'm living in the land that got no life for the first. The original man, that's why we get treated like criminals, fam. 50s posted on our block like Senator Stan. See, they give us all the bull. Shit with minimal land. Then we'll suck up all our shit like they got tentacles. Damn, yo, that's a capitalist. Nothing but facts that I kick. System built on our back while master cracked the whip. I'm just an average black man here in USA. Just being that a nigga feel like he need 2 SKs. Cause I seen it all before Diallo to Johnny Gims. No justice, no peace, all the words just up and bend.
We need red, black, and green. Dashikis, low shades, and guns with magazines. Fist in the air like Giancarlo and Thomas Smith. The ones who oppress are the ones I strongly diss. So we need red, black, and green. Families all united, blowouts with Apple Sheen. Fist in the air like Geronimo Pratt. But the ones who oppress are the ones I'm going next.
Hey yo, time stays ticking 24/7. Ask myself, Jay Sands, you want money or heaven? But do I gotta stop rhyming like Mace to show faith? Be at church every Sunday morning with no haste. I know folk who never miss and live life just so fake. Most time you never see me greasing before grace. You wanna preach, I wanna freak over beats and showcase. Talent plus some issues that plague the whole race. I have a voice and I'm using it. The problem is abusing it. How I'm gonna flow about life and stay confusing it? Trying to paint the picture that the record man sell. Man, I'm trying to paint the picture so the pecker can tell that Huey Newton, Bobby Seale didn't waste their time. Revolution's the solution for our fate to find. To the east, my brother on the Black Star Line. Any nigga disagreeing about these facts are blind. Be in the hood every day, see the games that they play. The only reason man make laws to see who obey. Cause everyone breaks them, every race, every day. Say kids in the burbs don't sniff and puff hay. With blacks it's a crime, with whites it's a problem. But see it's all the same and a cycle just stays revolving.
So we need red, black, and green. Dashikis, low shades, and guns with magazines. Fist in the air like Stokely and rap rhymes. The lies and deceits, we got the fucking battle. We need red, black, and green. Families all united for wilds with Afro Sheen. Fist in the air like Elhaz, Malisha Bass. The last,
hey yo, my thoughts burn like Mississippi when I'm tippy. Paranoid, smoking 50 with my nigga Picky. Talking about the devil and how he's so tricky. Got us caught for water these days, a buck 60. New world agenda, nothing for free. Sooner or later, you gon' have to pay for air that you breathe. Are we too far gone? I really don't know. It'd be a shame if we destroy this planet all for the dough. Plus the babies, we need to tell them now. What, where, why, when, and how. They don't respect us, cause we don't respect ourselves. We'd rather diss our own brothers before we let affect our wealth. I give any black man the benefit of a doubt, cause none of us are innocent. So I shout, red, black, and green. So we know where we came from and know what we've seen. And realize when we're divided, we are the worst. And realize when we're united, we are the first. So we got red, black, and green. Dashikis, low shades, and guns with magazines. Fist in the air like Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. The ones who oppress are the ones that lead the fall. So we got red, black, and green. Families all united, flow out with Apple Sheen. Fist in the air like Fred Hampton and Bunchy Carter. We fight for our lives, our sons, and our daughters.